the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
People do support the Peter B. Collins Show, and my thanks today to Eugene Kenny, Michael Gill, Patricia Player, and Anthony Sassone. If you're able and you'd like to help, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links to our voluntary subscriptions starting at $5 a month are right there on the right-hand side of the homepage. We've got a three-part podcast for you today. Up first, Shahid Buttar, the executive director of the national organization called the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, joins me at Occupy Berkeley, and we talk about the Bill of Rights implications for the protests that have broken out all over the world. Also on today's program, investigative reporter Jason Leopold on how the CIA got the wrong man, and it's happened more than once. And Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights reports on the effort to bring George W. Bush to justice. That's all ahead today.
I'm in the People's Republic of Berkeley today with Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and we have just visited two of the Occupy encampments here in Berkeley. What are your thoughts, Shahid?
It's inspiring to see people from so many different places and so many different ages and backgrounds raising their voices together. I think it's really exciting, especially on the day that the Oakland Occupy site was just raided by police agencies, including the Berkeley Police Department, to see people here raising their voices around the full set of issues that concern them.
Mm-hmm. And what are the Bill of Rights issues that come into play around the tension between the protesters who claim a First Amendment right and the authorities who claim that there are issues related to public safety and health?
At least you mentioned the first, and so this definitely implicates the First Amendment right of assembly, as well as the right of speech, as well as, for that matter, the Fourth Amendment right against searches and seizures. And you see in each of the police crackdowns on the Occupy sites that have happened, for instance, in Oakland or Seattle over the weekend, a very profound abuse of each of those different constitutional rights, the right to assemble, the right to speak, and the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. I think it's interesting that in the routine context, like if a cop wants to just stop somebody to see what they have in their pockets or their bag, there is a requirement that our courts currently recognize that the police have individual suspicion that a criminal offense has or may be committed. There's no such restriction when they're raiding camps of First Amendment protected occupiers or demonstrators, and I think there's a real problem there.
Yeah. And in Oakland, we have this rich contrast because Oakland has a serious crime issue. Mayor Jean Kwan, and I may agree with her essentially on the issues of not imposing a curfew and not using the civil courts for gang injunctions, but I consider it highly hypocritical when she authorized is a crackdown on peaceful protesters, claiming that a couple of minor skirmishes that appear to be with, you know, mentally ill or other people or even some interlopers, that requires the police to step in. Any thoughts about that contrast?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the big problems in the police interdicting groups of any kind on the basis of the isolated acts of a few members is the First Amendment right of association, right, which is even within the right to assemble. And we have a very deeply embedded norm throughout our justice system against collective punishment, but that's exactly what raids on Occupy sites or infiltrating activist groups or faith institutions. You know, our police and intelligence agencies, unfortunately, burden associational rights constantly. And the idea of guilt by association is emerging as a new norm that we accept in a whole range of contexts. In the immigration enforcement regime, mass hearings have now become common. There's the FBI's investigating peace activists and labor organizers on the basis of their associational activity. And in the context of these raids, like by the Oakland Police Department, you see an associational criminalization of entire sets of people, most of whom, the vast majority of whom, have never at any point done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it is both hypocritical as well as opportunistic. And I would even go so far as to say very profoundly un-American. I mean, this is the kind of thing we would expect from the Saudi police or, you know, the Egyptian military before the Jasmine Revolution. You know, this is the sort of behavior we would expect from China or the former Soviet Union, not police agencies here in the United States of America.
Shahid, there have been several incidents captured on video, first in Santa Cruz, and then I've seen one in St. Louis, and it's specific to the Bank of America. Protesters who want to go into the bank to close their accounts are told that they can't be customers and protesters at the same time. I think that's bullshit.
It is at least that. I at different points have been a Bank of America customer. I'm proud to say I'm not anymore. And I'm certainly a protester of a great many things. And I think that reflects a real ignorance on the part of whomever at the bank seems to think that their customers don't include the 99% of Americans who are raising their voices against rapacious profiteering and the placement of profit over people by the banking industry.
Mm-hmm. Is there a legal issue there that can be litigated, do you think?
There's a legal issue. Whether it can be litigated is really a different question. I mean, I guess the question precisely would be whether or not a customer of a bank has a right to go in to the establishment, period, or whether that's access granted by the bank. And if short of the legal right, it's at least a horrible business decision, because what the Bank of America rep is saying is if you're a Bank of America customer, you don't have any First Amendment rights, which is obviously preposterous. I don't know where a bank would get off trying to take away someone's constitutional rights. But so it's at least a legal issue. Whether or not a court would step in, which is the question about litigability, that's another question. I mean, I don't know. I don't put a lot of faith in our courts generally, mm-hmm. for what that's worth. So I would tend to think not. But at the very least, yeah, there's very clear, a pretty profound strike against the rights of the bank's customers, which I think is interesting. They're not even talking about the protesters. They're talking about their own customers not having the right to raise their voices and still get to their own money. That's preposterous. Sounds like theft to me more than a First Amendment violation.
Or kidnapping, you know. Unlawful detention of my money. Shahid, you've been working with members of the Berkeley City Council to develop a local ordinance which would, at least in part, prevent the police department from infiltrating groups like Occupy Berkeley. Talk a little bit about that and the other elements of the package.
Sure. There are three members of the Berkeley City Council who invited some support in crafting a set of measures to restrict the Berkeley Police Department in a range of different kinds of abuses. And so you mentioned one of them, the infiltration of activist groups, which broadly construed relates to intelligence collection. You know, police departments around the country no longer do just public safety or criminal law enforcement. They're also being roped by the federal government into performing a whole range of intelligence collection activities. And so the proposal here in Berkeley has three components. One of them is the requirement, which already exists in our federal constitutional law, even though agencies just ignore it routinely. And that requirement is that for police agencies or intelligence agencies to collect intelligence information about law-abiding people, they have to have at least reasonable suspicion that they've done something wrong, kind of like what we were talking about before in the context of stop and frisks. It just so happens that in the intelligence arena, police and the FBI in particular recognize no limit on their authorities, and so this is essentially about restoring the Fourth Amendment to activists. There's, as well as other groups that the authorities infiltrate and monitor, like Muslims, Arabs, South Asians. The second component of the bill relates to racial profiling by police, and the bill would require the police department, as many others are currently required under consent decrees, to at least collect data to show who in the city, what demographics are being stopped, searched, arrested, subjected to force, or charged with criminal penalties, so that residents of Berkeley and the city council can say with some degree of empirical assurance whether or not profiling is happening. And then the third portion of the bill relates to the Berkeley Police Department's involvement with federal immigration authorities and the biometric data collection program that the FBI is using immigrants to construct.
Mm-hmm.
People have heard in some context about the Secure Communities Initiative, which in some people present as an immigrant deportation program, and it is that. It's much more than that. The Secure Communities Initiative is the first of many, a whole series of FBI programs together called the Next Generation Initiative, and through NGI, the Next Generation Initiative, the FBI is trying to construct a biometric database of all Americans. And the Secure Communities Initiative is basically the first, it's the thin edge of the wedge, and the idea is the government is using immigrants as political bait to convince the rest of the country to allow the creation of a national ID system using our bodies instead of our cards. And so this bill that those members of the Berkeley City Council, Chris Worthington, Jesse Adeguin, and Max Anderson are supporting, and will soon introduce, will essentially block each of those different abuses by the Berkeley Police Department. And for me as an advocate, what's most exciting to see was like at the event just last night that a bunch of groups here hosted together at a Unitarian Universalist church, where all of the different sectors of the Berkeley community coming together to stand in common for each other's rights. You know, there were South Asians there were Latinos there were African Americans there, young folks, old folks, people who were new to activism, people who'd been doing it for decades, and there really is this very broad cross-section of the community that is concerned about the rights that we all share as Americans.
You mentioned infiltration by the authorities, and this is not a local case, but a very important federal issue. We have this recently exposed and alleged plot by an Iranian-American from Texas, allegedly trying to hire a Mexican drug cartel person who turned out to be a DEA informant to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington. It is a far-fetched plot, even on the face of it. And the role of the DEA informant is highly suspect because there have been at least 17 domestic terrorism prosecutions that had at the center a paid FBI or other government informant. I don't know if you've looked at this case in any detail, but it's really stinky to me.
It is?
It's about as stinky as that weed that we're smelling here in the park in Berkeley.
It is the People's Republic, as you mentioned earlier, right? Yes, I think the case is very smelly. I can't confess to have examined it as closely as I have other cases. I think the problem here ultimately is that the government, our federal government in particular, but increasingly using state and local police, are disregarding the constitutional limits on this kind of behavior. You know, it was 30 years during the COINTELPRO era that the Bureau was doing this kind of work unapologetically, and not just infiltrating groups that, you know, potentially posed some threat to public safety, but also the NAACP, movements trying to bring an end to the war in Vietnam, the women's rights movement, Puerto Rican independence, Native American independence, you know, sort of grab bag of issues. And in recent years, we've seen the same kind of abuses against activist groups on issues ranging from resisting the death penalty, groups on both sides of reproductive choice, anti-choice and pro-choice groups alike. Environmental activists have particularly been targeted by these kinds of infiltrations. And the fact is that if you have government infiltrators in activist groups, regardless of whether or not those groups do anything wrong, individuals within them can become subject to investigation. And there are 24 peace and justice activists, labor organizers, and immigrant rights activists around the country, primarily in the upper Midwest, but also Southern California, who are currently under investigation by the FBI for essentially thought crimes. These are nonviolent offenses. Most of them, in fact, all but one, have never actually been charged with an offense. So they just have this sort of Damocles hanging over them while all of their records and computers have been seized for over a year now, and they've never had a chance to confront witnesses or evidence against them. Mm-hmm. And you could see similarly, not only is it the case that people become at risk of investigation for merely exercising their rights, but a whole further problem here is that we resign any opportunity in this kind of work to actually do real investigation, mm-hmm. right? It's interesting, in the drug war, for instance, we don't go after junkies for sniffing glue, right? We want to go after distributors and producers. And so in the war on terror, you could say maybe the DOD, the Defense Department, is going after producers abroad, and you could say that the FBI and these local police that are infiltrating activist groups maybe are, you know, if you stretch the facts and presume that they're actually going after people who would sign up for plots, the consumers. But there's no effort in this arena to go after actual distributors. It's stupid, not just from a constitutional rights standpoint, but it's completely stupid from a public safety standpoint. And I think it's ridiculous not only that these agencies are taking our tax money, but that they're taking our tax money to abuse our rights. It's like pouring salt on a wound. And I think it's high time that we, the people, stood up and did something about it.
finally, Shahid, on the Fifth Amendment and the execution of Anwar al-Awlaki and his teenage children, a son 17 and a son 16, all killed by drone strikes in Yemen. And in the case of the father, he was placed by an unknown group, a subcommittee of the National Security Council, on a list that said he should be killed or captured. And I'm outraged by this, and I'm further outraged that there isn't much outrage on the part of the American people.
I think there's at least some outrage. I mean, the problem, to be honest, and you're absolutely right, that it's completely lawless, has no basis in our Constitution. I mean, that basically is the government authorizing the assassination of an American citizen abroad on the basis of what they say, right? I mean, this is someone who, you know, he wasn't found with a gun in his hand, and as far as we know, he himself never committed violence. And the idea that as long as we, and we're not even at war in any technical sense, right, the government hides behind the fact that we're, you know, for instance, in Libya, supposedly weren't engaged in hostilities, right, at any point that would trigger the War Powers Act. So, you know, there isn't even the formal declaration of war to justify these kinds of activities. And even though the Justice Department lawyers who wrote this policy, or the memo authorizing the strike, tried to limit their analysis, there's no reason a future president is going to feel constrained from citing this memo as the justification to assassinate the next U.S. citizen who says something the government doesn't like and happens to be abroad. So it's deeply unconstitutional. The challenge, I think, is simply that we are so committed already to lawlessness that it almost is just like another drop in the bucket, right? That we've already resigned ourselves to pervasive surveillance without any individual suspicion of criminal activity. We've resigned ourselves to arbitrary and indefinite detention without access to counsel or impartial courts. We've resigned ourselves to executive unaccountability for human rights abuses as severe as torture. And so the idea of extrajudicial assassination, like, yeah, what else is new? But it should concern all of us, and every drop in the bucket should give all of us some concern. And I think the outrage that you're missing is building. And I think, you know, here, for instance, at the Occupy sites, we see in process before us the exercise of the American people remembering how to raise our voices.
Shahid, thanks for doing what you do. We need you.
Thank you, sir. You're very kind. Thanks for having me on.
Still to come on the Peter B. Collins Show, the movement to bring to justice a rogue named George W. Bush. Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights joins us in our next segment. But first, Jason Leopold has another super scoop. Did they get the wrong man and torture him?
You thought it was me.
Our intro music from Vernon Reed. You may remember him from Living Color, and he used to hang out at a studio down the street from me here. And that one's called Mistaken Identity, which is the perfect way to set up Jason Leopold's new investigative report, exclusive at truthout.org. Jason, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Peter, great to be back with you.
And you did a combination print interview and video interview with a former CIA officer named Glenn Carl, and he has published a book, which I think you've read, but I haven't, called
Yes.
The Interrogator.
Yes.
And first of all, kudos to you, because you've advanced the story on a number of fronts. You're going to detail for us what he reported about some of the black sites, and the term black it carries deeper meaning than we may have thought. But this involves the case of a man who Glenn Carl is still not permitted to personally name, but he can affirm what you say when you talk about Haji Pasha Wazir.
Correct.
And he was an Afghan who was picked up by the CIA and was held for almost 10 years and finally released in 2010. But because he speaks French, and it was curious in your interview, at first Glenn Carl couldn't affirm, because of CIA restrictions, that French is the language that he's fluent in. But then he kind of dropped that charade.
Yes.
I was a little confused by his inconsistency there.
Yeah, basically the CIA, in his book, redacted it. They said, you know, you cannot identify the language that you speak, but you know, if he was asked, you know, do you speak a certain language, which is French, he could say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange, but it's, you know, that is what the CIA's Publication Review Board is sort of notorious for, are these bizarre redactions that they make, you know, in books. Sometimes it's, you know, it's supposed to be just for, you know, protecting intelligence sources and methods, but it goes far beyond that to just, you know, protect embarrassing info.
Well, and Jason, the issue of his language skills appears to be the only criteria used to invite him to become an interrogator. Here's a guy who worked for the CIA, spoke French, but didn't have any experience dealing with individual terrorists or interrogation processes. This is remarkable, and you open your story by reporting that the number two officer in the CIA's clandestine service, Rob Richer, came to Glenn Carl in December of 2002 and basically intimidated him into accepting this assignment that was well out of his expertise.
That's correct. I mean, you know, Glenn Carl spent more than two decades, in the CIA and in very, you know, senior positions at the agency. And, you know, he'll tell you that, hey, it wasn't just the fact that I spoke French, which is why the CIA, you know, asked him to take on this this case with this, you know, top Al-Qaeda figure that they claimed that they had. He'll say it was, you know, his analytical skills because he was also available. However, as you note, it's important to highlight that he had absolutely no interrogation experience whatsoever. He makes it very clear, as we all know now, that the CIA wasn't in that business. They were not in the interrogation business. They were, you know, he says explicitly that they were in the business of spying and stealing secrets and interrogating people was not something that they were had any experience with. So he did agree to take on the case, take the job, and headed out to Morocco to this black site prison that that was jointly operated by, you know, Moroccan intelligence and the CIA.
Well, and before we get to Morocco, I think it's important to focus on the conversation that Glenn Carl reports he had with Rob Richer, because to his credit, Glenn Carl raised questions and said, well, you know, I don't have to torture this guy. I'm not quoting him verbatim. But he basically was pushed back by Richer, who said, we are in that business. It's been authorized by the president, and this is your assignment. And Glenn Carl appeared to be very surprised by these developments. But as he described it, Richer cut the meeting short and basically just left him with his jaw dropped.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And he made it very clear. And also, you know, other agency officials made it clear that you'll do whatever you have to do to obtain intelligence from this guy. And if that means you need to torture him, you'll torture him. And by the way, here's the authorization. So yes, he was, you know, he says he was shocked and surprised, and I, you know, believe him. I think that he certainly showed that he was. But it's stunning because of the level of intelligence that the CIA apparently had on this individual, Mr. Wazir, which turned out to be completely wrong, and what they were willing to do in order to gain information, which he simply did not have.
Well, and this is quite consistent, and I'd love to see Glenn Carl become an advocate for those who were wronged by these policies. But, Jason, as you very well know, out of some roughly 775 people who were sent to Guantanamo, well over 600 of them were completely innocent.
That's exactly correct.
And WikiLeaks has confirmed in file after file, this guy didn't have any connection to terrorism. We can't find anything. Why do we keep him? And so the case of Wazir being falsely accused of being Osama bin Laden's banker is part and parcel with hundreds of others.
It's true. And what's interesting to me about this particular case, about the assertions that were made about Wazir, is that in some respect it's very similar to the assertions made about Abu Zubaydah, the first high-value detainee captured. In fact, in March of 2002, Wazir was captured sometime around December of 2002. But what's similar is that in both cases, the CIA had claimed that both these individuals were plotting attacks, were very valuable in terms of all the intelligence that they had, and it simply was not the case. With Zubaydah, certainly he did know some people that were going in and out of the camp that he had been operating at. But what the Bush administration had proclaimed just simply turned out not to be true, and we know that now, from some of the documents that that have been released that I have written about, and the same with Mr. Wazir.
Mm-hmm. And so Glenn Carl accepted the assignment. He goes to Morocco, and there was a second black site. Can you, because he was unable to be specific about those two locations, can you parse that for us? What's the difference between the Morocco site and the other that he wasn't willing to name?
The other site is the salt, what's known as the salt pit. That's the site, a black site in Afghanistan that is operated solely by the CIA. As I indicated, the one in Morocco where Wazir was at first was cooperated by Moroccan intelligence and the CIA. The one in Afghanistan is solely operated by the CIA. It was the site where one detainee was killed. Actually, excuse me, several detainees were killed. In fact, if you recall the movie Taxi to the Dark Side, documentary, Dilawar, and with one of the detainees there whose legs were pulped, just beaten, literally beaten to a pulp. He died there, as well as another detainee. There's an investigation that Special Prosecutor John Durham, who investigated the destruction of the torture tapes, he's reopened one investigation into Gul Rahman, who died at the site, the salt pit. So Glenn Carl says that this is the most severe of the black sites. It is where the most horrific things took place. Mm-hmm. And that's where, Wazir was sent about 6 or 7 months after, I believe. He was at the Moroccan site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
he calls it, excuse me, he refers to it as Hotel California,
mm-hmm.
in his book. From the Eagles song, and he says that the reason he chose that name, or his wife helped him choose that name, is it's a place that you can check out, but you can anytime you want, but you can never leave.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you can check in whenever you want, but you can never leave.
Yes.
Isn't that?
Sorry.
Yeah. And Jason, his story is extremely powerful, and it is consistent with what Ali Soufan has told us and others who are traditionalists when it comes to interrogation, and who not only rejected the torture or harsh interrogation regime promoted by John Yoo, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Office of the Vice President, but they believed it didn't work, and they don't present themselves as moral authorities. simply as practical people who know that torture doesn't actually deliver what the pro-torture people, policymakers, think it will. And Glenn Carl shared that point of view.
Yes, and he says that anyone who will state that torture works or that it's needed simply has no idea what they're talking about and has never been involved in any of the interrogations. You know, he makes it very clear in his book, by the way, Peter, that perhaps, well, I should say that he asks whether he became a torturer, whether he ended up being someone who tortured because of the psychological manipulation that he sort of implemented on Wazir. You know, he talks about the, you know, the sensory deprivation, the psychological torture, you know, that this man underwent. And I have to tell you that it's, you know, he refers to Wazir in his book as captive. And what he describes is that this is truly horrific, is that, you know, his life was ruined. We ruined his life. We destroyed his mind slowly. Slowly destroyed his mind because we needed to know where bin Laden was. And he makes a real important point of as to when he arrived out at the black side of Morocco, there was a CIA analyst who was interrogating Wazir. And what's important to note about that is that, you know, CIA analysts are usually folks that kind of sit behind the desk,
right,
collect intelligence. And here was this analyst who was responsible for collecting all the intelligence on Wazir, and there he was interrogating him, which was very unusual. And the interrogation consisted of, you know, tell us where bin Laden is. And he would respond, I don't know. And you better tell us where bin Laden is. And he was, you know, not being facetious about it. He said that's literally how the interrogation went. And, you know, he made it very clear to the CIA in Cable that, look, you know, he is sort of the equivalent of a person, Wazir, that is the, it would be the equivalent of a train conductor who sold a criminal a ticket.
Yeah.
He was not the person that the government had claimed he was. And he made it clear that he should be released immediately. Those cables, by the way, Peter, to this day, are nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. Somehow they disappeared. So it's such a troubling story on so many different levels. Not just for not just because we, you know, tortured and kidnapped, and he uses the word kidnapped, and I think that's very important as well. You know, we talk about rendition. He says kidnapped, you know, the wrong man. We had the wrong guy. And he tried to do his best to, you know, see to it that he could eventually be released. But when it came time to actually, you know, when he was able to obtain an attorney and even challenge his imprisonment through a habeas corpus proceeding, you know, the government lied, just simply lied again about all the, you know, the claims that they had made against him. And it wasn't really, if you look at the timeline, it wasn't until Glenn Carl started writing his book that suddenly things started to change and, hey, you know, this guy was released. So I don't think there's a coincidence there. I think that obviously it would have been very embarrassing, you know, for the CIA if Glenn Carl came out with a book, you know, stating all of these things that, and we were still holding this person.
Well, and let's put a face on this, because my old friend Leon Panetta was running the Central Intelligence Agency
right at
the time that this issue would have risen to his desk. And here's a man who was brushed back by Senator Kit Bond during his confirmation hearing for CIA director because he said that he was opposed to rendition and torture. And Kit Bond basically made him eat those words, And then, you know, we fast forward a couple of years, and here's Leon Panetta engineering redactions to Glenn Carl's book, engineering the release of Wazir, because it would have been even more embarrassing to have this revealed if he was still in U.S. custody, and really extending the dark era under Bush and really making that seamless. We cannot absolve the Obama team for the wrongdoing under Bush because they not only extended it, but they went to great lengths to cover it up and to protect, as we're going to talk about in the next segment, the individual leaders from any investigation, any accountability whatsoever.
That's correct. There's no question that, in fact, I was just reading the story on Panetta, by the way, Peter, since you brought him up. And, you know, this is a story published in a newspaper called The Ledger. And it's a pretty powerful story. It talks about how, you know, Leon Panetta came in, or rather, before he came into, you know, the Obama administration, he was harshly critical of the, you know, Bush administration, its kidnapping and torture policies that were in place. You know, this was also the same guy who was co-author of the Iraq, you know, study group report calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. In both instances, you know, he sought to cover up, you know, the torture and protect the torturers. And in the case of Iraq, he had called for keeping more troops there. And, you know, there was this quote by this woman, this former CIA officer, in that story that I just mentioned, who said that I'm completely disillusioned. You know, I feel that Leon Panetta was co-opted, completely co-opted. And I think that, you know, she makes obviously a very good and important point. It's just unbelievable the length that, you know, the administration continues to go to protect these people. And, you know, you read the story about this guy whose life was just shattered, completely shattered by the U.S. government. And here you have a very high-level CIA, you know, intelligence officer who is documenting it. And it still fascinates me, Peter, that it's not an issue that that there are people out there raising their fists saying, you know, accountability. I simply just don't understand it.
Well, and to that point, before we started this conversation off air, you and I were talking about the Occupy movement. And while we have, you know, great support for the general thrust of it, I hear mostly about economics, about mostly domestic issues. But I don't hear a clear call for a return to constitutional rule. And I'd like that to be a part of the protest message right now. I think it's very important, and it's not separate from the other issues.
Right. Agreed.
Yeah.
It's very important. And, you know, you and I have had these conversations, discussions often. This isn't going away. And I say that each and every time you and I speak. I'm certainly going to continue to dig into this. This, you know, story about Mr. Wazir is fascinating. I don't think that's going anywhere. And, you know, so while it may sort of go under the radar a bit, it's not going to disappear. And so it's crucial that, you know, we at least try to find out whether the rule of law still matters. It doesn't seem like it matters anymore, Peter. You know, there was a point, if I can just, you know, digress for a moment in during our interview, because Glenn Carl does not support accountability. He's still one of the, you know, as critical as he is of the agency, he's still a loyalist, and he does not support accountability. And, you know, I understand, you know, some of his arguments, but, you know, I made a point of reading to him this press release that the White House put out back in June about Gilad Shalit,
the Israeli soldier just released, yeah.
Right, and this press release, we had it in the video as well, said from the Obama administration, they, you know, criticized, I shouldn't even say criticized, just blasted Hamas for, quote, you know, kidnapping Gilad Shalit, holding him for 5 years outside the rule of law with no access to the International Committee of the Red Cross. Literally everything that we have done to hundreds, perhaps thousands, of prisoners and detainees in the war on terror over the past decade. The hypocrisy is truly stunning. And so, you know, you look at that, you know, just using that as an example, with Wazir, you know, this case that you know, we've been discussing, and it's identical. We did the exact same thing.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about Glenn Carl, because I appreciate in your role as a journalist, you restrained yourself, because I know you well enough personally that you were pretty offended by the remarks that Glenn Carl made, saying he didn't want to see investigations and that they would just become, you know, polarized political witch hunts. And as I watched him say that, I had a real mixed reaction, Jason, because I respect him and appreciate that he has published this book over great resistance from the CIA, and that he wants to clear his own conscience. At the same time, he is blocking any resolution of the wrongdoing that occurred, and it was not trivial or minor. It was serious and massive. And so I wrote this down as I was watching the video. I put down, good Nazi, question mark.
Exactly.
Partial denial. Is he still in some denial about the scope of these law-breaking and immoral activities? And then I wrote down, limited hangout. What is he not telling us that he could? This is a very important set of issues. It's one case. And maybe he only got called in to interrogate this guy, and after his misgivings, he didn't accept any further assignments. I don't know. But I have to say I was left dissatisfied by Mr. Carl's disclosures.
Yeah, no, I think that good. I think that everyone should be dissatisfied. In fact, the reaction, you know, to that particular moment in the video, and even in the, you know, in the text part of the story, in which I, you know, because he says that this would be seen, that, you know, this would divide the country. An investigation would divide the country. And yeah, I said to him, I said, Glenn, the country's already divided. We are already divided. How will this further divide the country?
Well, and I would argue that it would help unify the country by healing the wounds and giving us a common sense of the Constitution as our compass point.
Right, and I agree. And I think that, you know, what's important to note is that basically what he's saying is, look, you know, we're setting a precedent that there are people who are above the law. Because at this point, there now, can there ever be a moment, Peter, when government officials will be held accountable or can be held accountable? It doesn't appear that could be the case. Everything now is in the name of national security. We're just trying to protect the country. Well, you know, sorry, but there's you were actually given warnings. Glenn, you are the guy who warned and told the agency this is, you know, you've got the wrong guy. They continue to torture him for 8 years. So I agree with you, and I think that, you know, this is part of the problem with people like Ali Soufan, with Glenn Carl, with other intelligence officials who have, some of them at least, who have come forward and say, you know, torture is wrong, but I don't think anybody should really be held responsible for it. We should try to learn from it. I'm not sure why it can't be both.
Yeah, I fully agree. Now, Jason, there was something else in the interview that struck me, and it was a comment in passing that he made. And first, let me offer the context. You and Jeff Kay, who is a psychologist, have co-authored a number of important pieces about the role of psychologists in torture. And in fact, Glenn Carl refers to calling in a CIA psychologist during one of these sessions where they were torturing Wazir. And I think that's a very important, aspect of these matters. And also, Sibel Edmonds and I spoke recently with Stephen Solds, who is a psychologist from Boston, who has been leading an effort to get the American Psychological Association to properly come to terms with these issues, because they're playing a fast and loose game, which essentially does enable a psychologist to collaborate with the CIA in human experiments, including torture, without technically violating the ethics standards of the APA. So, as a part of your reporting with Kay, you have revealed that they reverse engineered the SEER program. The SEER program is how we train our troops to resist torture. And so they reverse engineered that. And as you know, I've been a little skeptical of that, because I believe that we never really stopped torturing, even after the Church and Pike Commission reports of the 1970s, when we claimed that we did.
No, I think you're right, Peter. I don't think that we ever did it either, and I agree with you on that.
And the School of the Americas was exporting torture all through the 1980s and into the 90s. So the reference he made in the context of Hotel California was a passing comment about the Kubark Manual. And the Kubark Manual was the torture manual that we said we destroyed after the Church and Pike Commissions in the 1970s. And so here he referred to the fact that we're not in that business, but he knew about the Kubark Manual. And I found that to be a very interesting issue that suggests a conflict in his commentary.
Well, I will tell you that Jeff Kay, since you mentioned him, he too raised that those very issues and those questions, particularly about the Kubark Manual. And, you know, Carl said he went through SEER training, survival, evasion, resistance, escape training, I guess about 20 years or so. And he says, and I think you're making a really good point here, Peter, he says time and again, you know, let me also just add a little bit more context here. You know, this was a two-hour discussion that we had on camera, and, you know, obviously we edited the videotape.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just to get into what was edited, he said that everything that he saw, what was taking place at the black sites in terms of the way it was set up, you know, the darkness, was right out of the Kubark Manual, right out of his SEER training.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he seems to sort of suggest that, no, we never destroyed it. It's, you know, it's still there. We still use it. And I, you know, I think that is very important. It's, you know, it's difficult to get people to, you know, again, as part of history, to really understand, as you noted, that, you know, I don't think that these things really ever went away. They went underground and, you know, out of our, we were not really aware of it. But there is some inconsistency there.
Yeah. Finally, Jason, in Carl's commentary, which you report in your exclusive piece for truthout.org, it really gives a new dimension to the term black site, and you referenced that a moment ago. Let me read this quote from Mr. Carl, referring to a black site. He said it was instantaneously completely black. Not dark, black. A darkness where literally I could not see my hand. Totally black. And there was loud, incessant noise, or a series of other sounds, babies wailing, sounds that would appear to be someone being hit, or car crashes, or wheels screeching. The goal is to play upon the senses so as to disorient the prisoner. Now, this seemed like a kind of disco of death, maybe without the beats.
Right, yeah. No, it's interesting, Peter. There, you know, that description is doesn't even have that much info, but it does give you an idea of perhaps, you know, what this prison was like. It's perhaps the most most information that has come to that has come forward to date, you know, regarding the black site. I mean, he really, as little as he offers, it's a lot, and. You know, again, he said that this was right out of his training. And, you know, I think that there's a lot more that, you know, to go into, to get, you know, deep into it. I actually asked him, were there chains hanging from the ceiling? Were there cuffs? Was it, you know, it almost sounded like this was a dungeon out of, you know, medieval time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he didn't get into detail about that, but it sort of, it seems clear that that's truly what it was.
Yeah. And Jason, one of the things that remains a known unknown, if I can channel Rummy here for a moment, is the dimension of our gulag in Afghanistan. Because we believe the salt pit was taken down and replaced by a new unit at Bagram, where they rebuilt the prison. And yet we've had reporting from Anand Gopal about many detention
right.
centers scattered around. We have the UN report that was recently issued that says that Afghan authorities are using torture and other illegal and devious means on large numbers of people who are being held in various locations in Afghanistan. But specific to Bagram, the United States under Barack Obama refuses to even identify the names of the individuals who are being held there, thought to be between 5 and 7,000. And it's also believed that some of those people were not originally detained in Afghanistan and that this has become the new Guantanamo. Did Carl shed any light on any of those issues?
No. Once he left the Black Site prison, and this was before Wazir was eventually sent to Bagram. And let me just add that, you know, since you mentioned Bagram, that we're in fact expanding it, building a new facility there to house another 2,000 or so prisoners. And that's currently happening. But, you know, once he left, that was it for him. You know, he went back to headquarters. He wasn't really in any other, you know, as far as I can tell, operational role. He no longer had a need to know, he said. So he didn't really pay too much attention to it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is becoming another Guantanamo, and these people are being held outside of the law, not even allowed to challenge their imprisonment before a court of law. So, you know, to use that example of that I had mentioned earlier of Gilad Shalit, we have thousands of them there, thousands of people there that are being held, and I think, you know, in terms of quote the Black Site prison run by the CIA. Perhaps some of the names are just changing. Maybe we don't call it a Black Site prison anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just difficult to tell, Peter, but, mm-hmm. you know, there's no accountability. And what's more important, there's no transparency. I really need to, you know, to just sort of note that this, you know, once again, this president, Peter, as you know, signed an executive order promising to usher in a new era of open government transparency. It has been anything but transparent. In fact, for me, I've been trying to, you know, obtain information regarding this case, this specific case on Wazir, from the government, and they refuse to release anything or even entertain a FOIA request. Not much has changed. And that goes for, you know, Bagram as well.
Well, I can add one little factoid about the new prison at Bagram. It was constructed, at least in part, by members of the Michigan National Guard. I was in Detroit this past year, and in a backyard barbecue, I met a guy who is a general in the Corps of Engineers portion of the Michigan National Guard. And he told me that he had supervised the construction of the new prison. And when I asked him for more details, he went to get some hot dog buns and didn't return.
Yeah. It's highly, highly secretive.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate that this is just sort of fading away. And again, you know, Carl's book is just important, and what he has to say is important, what he's revealing is important, because it sort of, to me, is the example, one of the examples of what a disaster this whole, you know, war on terror was, has been, continues to be.
Well put. Jason Leopold, truthout.org. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks for another great investigative report.
Thanks, Peter.
Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, we ask the question, will George W. Bush ever be brought to justice? Remember this one from 05?
Got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had. Got the job 'cause of his dad, now we're all in danger. Come around, up to no good. Broke the old treaties 'cause he could. Struts all around like a hood. Got us in a world of trouble. Put him in a straitjacket, there's no doubt. Let the psychiatrist figure him out. Listen while the demonstrators cheer and shout. We'll all feel better in the morning.
That's from a folkie named Yikes McGee from Baltimore. And it sends it up in a kind of funny way. But there are serious issues regarding investigations and accountability for members of the Bush administration, starting at the top with Bush, Cheney, David Addington, the vice president's alter ego, and Donald Rumsfeld over at the Department of Defense, to name just a few. Over at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, they are working on this accountability largely because the Obama Justice Department has failed and not only turns a blind eye, but it appears to be a policy matter that they will not pursue any criminal wrongdoing from the previous administration. Catherine Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and she has been working for more than 6 years on international law violations and accountability issues related to the torture policies of the Bush era and universal jurisdiction. We'll get her to explain for our non-legal minds what that means. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take a quick second to sketch what universal jurisdiction is and what options we have, since the U.S. government will not do its duty and enforce the laws against people who, I believe, broke them with impunity during the 8 years of Bush and Cheney.
Sure. Universal jurisdiction is a legal concept that really came into being after World War II. And it's in the Geneva Conventions first and later in the Convention Against Torture. And essentially what this principle stands for is that there are some actions, some violations that are so egregious that they are criminal everywhere in the world. So regardless of whether you're a citizen of a particular country or a victim with a certain nationality, every court in the world should be able to have jurisdiction over those who are responsible for these most egregious actions.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're talking about torture, genocide, crimes against humanity. And in the case of the Bush administration officials, of course, we allege that they are responsible for torture, among other serious international law violations.
Now, you recently took some action in Canada to try to essentially tag George W. Bush when he visits our northern neighbor for a speech. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, the underlying policy of the Obama Justice Department is infuriating to me. And I find it insulting as an American citizen and someone who believes in the Constitution that they can declare optional the idea of investigating what appears to be clear wrongdoing. And if we just focus on the most egregious cases of torture and the unlawful and unexplained deaths of three Guantanamo inmates in June of 2006, just as one case. Here, President Obama appears to have instructed his Justice Department not to pursue justice. And I'm not a lawyer, but in lay terms, that amounts to obstruction of justice, in my view.
Yeah, no, we have a serious problem in the United States. And I think it was a problem that many of us hoped we would see an end to when the Obama administration took office. But soon after he became president, Barack Obama said, we have to look forward, not behind, in regards to the crimes of the Bush administration.
And excuse me, but what legal principle is this former constitutional law professor embracing when he says, look forward, not backward?
Absolutely none. And this is not only wrong as a matter of law, because we have a torture statute on the books in the United States which empowers the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute those who commit acts of torture. And we have to remember that George Bush, in his memoir, has famously recognized and acknowledged and admitted brazenly that he authorized acts of torture when he authorized the waterboarding of individuals in secret CIA detention facilities. Eric Holder, during his confirmation hearing, of course, also said that waterboarding is a violation of law and an act of torture. Now, as Attorney General, we don't have Eric Holder opening investigations against the former president or, frankly, many other members of his administration who also should be subjected to investigation and ultimately prosecution.
Now, I'm sure you've thought about this and with greater depth than I'm capable of, but do we have any options domestically? I know I can't go to small claims court, but Vincent Bugliosi wrote a book about trying to indict George W. Bush for murder based on misleading American troops into Iraq who were then killed. And he had novel ideas about any district attorney could file a case on these charges, and I believe he claims there's no statute of limitations. So I'm sure you've looked at all of the options available. Do you find any?
Well, what we have here is much more a lack of will than a lack of law. Certainly there are district attorneys across the country who could be opening an array of investigations and prosecutions against members of the Bush administration, including, of course, George W. Bush. But thus far, we have not seen any prosecutor willing to take this case on. And it's in the absence of a U.S. prosecutor doing their job that we are looking outside the borders of the United States. But, of course, I would like to see this case prosecuted here in the United States, and that's where it should be prosecuted.
And have you read Bugliosi's book? Do you have any opinion on the validity of his proposed approach?
Yeah, I've certainly looked at his book, and I do think whether it's for smaller crimes or ultimately for torture, there is jurisdiction that a DA in a local office could bring charges. And, you know, we have seen initiatives taken here in the United States when different members, high-level members of the Bush administration have gone on their book tours. We've seen citizens delivering indictments, delivering evidence to local DAs or local U.S. attorneys and pushing for a prosecution. But, of course, unfortunately, we haven't seen anyone yet actually take that case up.
Now, in 2009, Catherine Gallagher, I talked with Michael Ratner, who is now, I think, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he was reporting that a group of people with him had set a trap for Donald Rumsfeld in Paris. And as I recall, Rumsfeld used a second exit to avoid contact with the people who had a subpoena or a warrant for him. Can you flesh out my weak memory on that incident, please?
Sure. Well, I don't know all the details of the second tour, but I do know that when Donald Rumsfeld was making a trip to Paris as a private citizen in 2007, the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with the International Federation for Human Rights and the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin, worked together very, very quickly to put together a case, presented a case with strong evidence, and there Donald Rumsfeld evaded prosecution and was assisted by the Paris prosecutor, who actually made the very disturbing finding that even if Donald Rumsfeld had committed acts of torture, those acts were done in official capacity as Secretary of Defense, and thus he should be immune. And I think when we step back and look at that, that's a shocking statement that a Paris prosecutor would think that part of the job of a U.S. Secretary of Defense is to torture detainees.
And this Paris prosecutor, some relative of John Hughes?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, what we're finding in country after country where we're trying to use universal jurisdiction, not across the board, but we're finding that these cases, of course, are viewed as hot potatoes. And it takes a strong judge or a strong prosecutor is deeply committed to the principles of the independence of the judiciary and the independence of their job as a prosecutor to take these cases forward. And thankfully, we've seen that in Spain.
Now, just last week, there was a potential showdown in Canada because George W. Bush, as he's promoting his book and picking up huge speaker fees, was speaking in British Columbia in the town of Surrey. Give us the background here of what you did to attempt to start a legal process against Bush in British Columbia.
Sure, and as a little bit more background on that trip, what George Bush, along with Bill Clinton, were going to speak to people in British Columbia about was their economic policies and, you know, as experts on economics. So there were some people in Surrey who were concerned enough, just, you know, here we're bringing George Bush to talk to us about economics. What we've heard is George Bush was paid $150,000 to give this speech. And about 3 weeks ahead of the talk, we started our work. We put together a draft indictment, 69 pages, with over 4,000 pages of supporting material. We presented this to the Attorney General of Canada, reminded him of his obligations as a signatory of the Convention Against Torture to investigate and prosecute George Bush when he entered Canadian territory. We received no response from the Attorney General. We reminded him again 2 weeks later, and then finally, on the day that George Bush actually arrived in Canada, we filed what's known as a private prosecution on behalf of four individuals who were tortured during the Bush administration at Guantanamo with the court itself. To initiate the prosecution, the Attorney General was unwilling to open.
And the individuals, I want to name them because they are people, and they deserve our respect after what they went through. Hassan bin Attash, Sami El Haj, Mohammed Khan Toumani, and Murat Kurnaz.
Thank you.
And tell us about the, you know, just briefly, if you would, their own feelings about George W. Bush. Because, Catherine, I've talked to a number of people who have been released from Guantanamo, and I find it remarkable. I often will apologize to them as an American for what they went through. And to an individual, each one says, well, thank you, but I'm not angry with individual Americans. They have a very strong sense of who did them wrong. And I appreciate that after what they went through, that so many of them don't have a broad-based hatred of every American.
Absolutely not. You're right on that point. It is a generosity of spirit that I do also find quite astounding. The individuals who filed this case, I've only been in touch with three of them, not the fourth, who is still detained in Guantanamo. I worked with his lawyer. But, you know, these cases are not about revenge or retribution. These cases are about accountability. The efforts by these individuals is to have their story heard, to ensure that what happened to them is marked as it needs to be, which is as a crime, that someone is held accountable, ultimately for the purpose of preventing this from happening to someone else again in the future. So I think filing the private prosecution, ultimately we have not been successful, and the reason we have not been successful is immediately after we filed this case, the Attorney General of British Columbia intervened and said that the case should be stayed, that the case should be stopped. Now, he did that within hours of our filing the case. Clearly, he did not read the accounts of what happened to these four men since he acted so quickly. That's the only conclusion I can come to. And that's so disappointing because part of what these private prosecutions are about is to also have the facts finally adjudicated, the individual accounts of what happened to Sami El Haj, Mohammed Khan Toumani, Murat Kurnaz, and Hassan bin Attash examined and entered into the historical record. And the Attorney General in British Columbia shut that process down even before it started.
Well, we have seen that the Obama administration has gone to great lengths to not only prevent prosecution or investigation of the probable crimes that occurred, but to reach out even to allied governments and threaten them with retaliation if they permit justice to be served. And in that case, I'm referring explicitly to Binyan Muhammad and four co-defendants whose case was thrown out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco based on claims of state secrets privilege by the Obama administration. But at the same time, they were threatening the British government with deteriorating relations and kind of nonspecific threats if they permitted Muhammad, who is a British resident, to make a claim in British courts. And this is extraordinary and deeply troubling to me.
Yes, and we saw the Bush administration do the same thing against Germany when we filed a case against Donald Rumsfeld in Germany back in 2004, exerting very, very strong diplomatic pressure. And then in our cases in Spain, through WikiLeaks, we learned of the lengths that the Obama administration tried to go to pressure the Spanish prosecutor and the Spanish courts and the Spanish Ministry of Justice to intervene to shut down investigations of torture by U.S. officials in Spain. And the only thing that I'm pleased of in that outcome is that the Spanish judges were independent enough at that stage to not buckle under the pressure of the Obama administration. Again, you know, a president who, as you said, is himself a lawyer and should be upholding the rule of law and not subverting it.
And as we look at this, these are fundamental human rights. And to see this president operating in the manner that he has to cover up for Bush and Cheney, even as Bush has kept quiet, but Cheney continues to snipe at him from the bleachers. And it doesn't make sense on a political level. It sets very bad precedents. It allows future presidents to play fast and loose with the law and the Constitution. And all they have to do is say, well, a terrorist made me do it. And so these are not trivial concerns. And that's why I fully support your attempts to serve some sort of justice, starting with George W. Bush.
Well, thank you. And, you know, you talk about future presidents playing fast and loose. I think we have to look at what the Obama administration is doing itself, whether through the use of targeted assassination or drones. We're seeing some very scary practices under the current president. So whether he's looking to protect past presidents, future presidents, or even himself, it's a very, very scary precedent. And it's also not only affecting us here in the U.S., but it's weakening the rule of law in the international human rights system. The longer the U.S. says, hey, the rules don't apply to us, let's change those rules. So I hope we can see some change.
And real change. I find it hard to read the Canadian government as well, and I realize that they may have changed parties over the last few years. But CCR represented Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was subject to rendition and torture, and ultimately he did win a settlement from the Canadian government. So they acknowledged that he had been wronged. But in American courts, he has repeatedly been washed out and rejected under this claim of state secrets and the so-called war on terror. So what is your characterization of the Canadian government when it comes to its relationship with the United States and this very critical but sensitive issue about justice related to torture?
Yeah, I would have to say the overall picture is a very bleak one. I think we see a government that was willing to put politics and relationships ahead of the rule of law. Whether what happened in Maher's case with Canada is an anomaly, that should be the way it is in every case, where you have a fundamental violation of a basic right, like the right to be free of torture. You should see the Canadian government standing up for torture survivors and not taking the back and protecting George Bush in the face of tremendous evidence that he bears responsibility for what happened to these individual men.
There's a powerful new documentary that is showing up at film festivals, and I don't know when it will be in a full release, but it's based on the story of the Canadian teenager Omar Khadr. And the film uses videotapes that were released by a Canadian court from Guantanamo when this young man was interrogated by Canadian agents who came and tried to win his confidence as they were clearly doing the dirty work of American intelligence. And it's just tragic and brutal to watch this. And they kind of bury the lead because it's mostly about his treatment and the way the Canadian government was trying to manipulate him. But buried in it is a very substantive claim that Omar Khadr was not guilty of throwing a grenade that killed an American serviceman in Afghanistan. And it appears that he was injured before that occurred, and yet our media, the political opposition in this country, no one is willing to take on the case of a child who was caught up in this crossfire, ended up tortured in Afghanistan and at Guantanamo, and then had to plea bargain in order to finally put an end to his nightmare.
Yeah, I don't want to go into the specific facts of that case. The film is called You Don't Like the Truth.
Right.
I haven't seen it, but I have colleagues who have, and I definitely would like to see it. I've heard it is an incredibly powerful and an incredibly devastating film. The detention of teenagers, including Omar Khadr, you know, three of the four individuals who filed in Canada in this case last week were teenagers at the time they were detained. There are not other countries that are running around saying, let's pick up teenagers and hold them in detention without charge for years and then ultimately try and prosecute them. We have something seriously off here in the United States when you look at who was in Guantanamo and how they were treated.
Indeed. Well, Catherine, I want to thank you for your work, and to the extent you wish to share it, what do you see as next steps here?
Well, I think when it comes to George Bush, we will continue to look for opportunities, whether domestically or internationally, to hold him accountable. On the larger accountability front internationally, we're looking to continue to build the cases that are currently open in Spain and to press for really full-scale investigation of the U.S. torture program from there until the day that we can get that investigation done properly here in the United States.
Well, I appreciate it, and this may take a long time, but I want you to know that you have support from people like me and my listeners, because we really want to see justice served here, and it can't be done by sweeping it under the rug or claiming that we're looking forward, not backward. Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, do me a favor, will you? Put this up on your Facebook page and then click like and share it with your friends. Then send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. You'll be done.
Trails to you until again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.